From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. So now we are in the stifling dog days of summer, tied by the ancients to the rising star of Sirius the Dog. The ancients called the dog days evil days. Homer said they brought fevers to suffering humanity. John Brady wrote in the 1800s that these days soured wine, maddened dogs, and afflicted man with diseases, hysterics, and frenzies. Do you feel it? I ask because you, like many Americans, may be struggling for some cooling comfort, refreshing predictions of better times to come. Don't count on it. Prognosticators, especially political ones, are so often so very wrong. Remember?
Jeb Bush is the strongest general election nominee by far. He's got the best message for a general.
He's going to raise the most money. The establishment likes him the best. A lot of members of Congress would like to see him be the nominee. And obviously, to some extent, it's his turn in the primogeniture of the party.
Oopsie.
Well, it is game over for Jeb Bush after disappointing results in South Carolina.
Then there was Bernie Sanders.
An adorable socialist, but probably not a serious candidate.
But,
Senator Sanders did an unbelievable job. Let's be honest. He brought the party in the right direction. He excited people. He had good policy positions that are actually built in the platform that will be on the floor tomorrow.
And the early reactions to the future GOP nominee.
Trump is America's summer fling.
This is a phenomenon that is going to fade sooner rather than later.
I think last night is the beginning of the end for Trump. That is my prediction.
Ah, halcyon days.
I humbly and gratefully accept your nomination for the presidency of the United States.
Because of this terrible, horrible, no good, very bad year for the talking heads, we've updated and are re-airing a show that was first broadcast in March, all about the perilous art of political prognostication. Because even in the best of years, media predictions rarely beat a magic eight ball.
Phil Tetlock is a professor of psychology and management at the University of Pennsylvania and is an expert on prognostication. He's conducted two landmark studies that uncover the finer points of forecasting. The first, Expert Political Judgment, How Good Is It? How Can We Know? And more recently, Super Forecasting, The Art and Science of Prediction. Phil, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you.
People like you break down prognosticators into two general categories.
You know, there's an old joke that there are two types of people, those who divide the world into two types of people and those who don't. But you're right. I talked about foxes and hedgehogs in the early work, and I think it's a critical distinction. It helps to be a little more fox-like, a little more self-critical, a little more eclectic, willing to draw ideas from lots of different places. You pay a price for committing to one point of view and trying to assimilate everything into it. And that's more or less what the hedgehogs do.
As you flip around your cable channels, do you see more foxes or do you see more hedgehogs?
The hedgehogs outnumber the foxes by a very substantial margin, and there's a pretty obvious reason for that. The hedgehogs give the media the sound bites that they want. Hedgehogs have one big idea. They try to assimilate everything into that big idea, and that makes for a compelling narrative package. Foxes are more likely to interrupt their flow of thought with things like but, however, although. So that led me to propose one very simple rule of thumb for distinguishing more fox-like from more hedgehog-like pundits. Foxes are more likely to say however, and hedgehogs are more likely to say moreover. So you have the however over moreover ratio.
Hedgehogs, you say, are historically less reliable. That's not just a qualitative judgment that you've made. You know their batting averages.
We do. We keep the track records over extended periods of time. One of the reasons why the more hedgehog-like forecasters have bad batting averages is that they're so aggressive, intellectually aggressive. They're like batters who are swinging for home runs all the time, and they strike out a lot.
Oh, it's like Ryan Howard of my Phillies. He hits about 229 with power, but there's an ongoing question of whether he's any longer useful to the team. Are these guys, these hedgehogs, useful to the team, or more to the point, are they useful to democracy?
Well, there's a big illusion that develops over time. The hedgehogs are swinging really hard. They're making confident judgments. They're often assigning pretty high probabilities to low-frequency events. If you do that often enough, sometimes you're going to be right. and you're going to be hauled out in front of the media as, here's the guy who predicted the rise of Islamic fundamentalism, here's the guy who predicted the Russian invasion of the Ukraine or the Syrian civil war or the whatever, because they're predicting so much of the time. Like the broken clock theory, the broken clock is right twice a day. There will virtually always be some extremist hedgehogs who are going to be well-positioned to claim credit for predictive successes.
Now, Phil, this hour was occasioned in part because it seems that nearly every elite political pundit and some not-so-elite ones, like me, got Trump completely wrong. And it seems that if we believe we knew anything about our nominal areas of expertise, we in the punditocracy have learned our lesson. Jack Schaefer, the media critic at Politico, called Trump a black swan. Tell me, what is a black swan?
The idea comes from the fact that Europeans didn't know about the existence of black swans until they got to Australia. Black swans were sort of unthinkable. And that's a metaphor for things that are radically unpredictable. Nobody saw them coming, but after the fact, everybody has an explanation for them.
What makes this guy such a black swan that he could have so flummoxed just everybody in the prognostication arts?
Donald Trump is not a totally black swan. He's more of a dark gray swan. There were people in the summer of 2015 who thought he had some low probability chance. Maybe been 5%, 10%. And over time, they've gradually increased that probability as Trump has proven to be much more politically durable than virtually everybody in the know thought. Here's the bum rap that a lot of pundits get. Let's just say for sake of argument that you're a wonderful pundit and you're well calibrated, which means that when you say that something is 90% likely, that thing happens 90% of the time. You say 70%, that thing happens 70% of the time. And something you say is 90 or 95% unlikely happens. Does that mean you're automatically a terrible forecaster? No. Sometimes unlikely things happen. If you're a perfectly calibrated forecaster and you say something is 95% likely, 5% of the time, you should be wrong.
Now, Phil, as you know, our partner in this project is Nate Silver and 538.com. It does gather all of the available data and contemporaneous polls and historical data and say, under these conditions, 73% of the time, so-and-so will win. But Nate didn't see Trump coming either. Do you have any thoughts on this?
Sure. Nate Silver and his team at 538 are extraordinarily adept at analyzing poll data. There really weren't a lot of quantitative data to crunch about Donald Trump in the summer of 2015. The question in this situation isn't, you know, did you see an extremely gray swan from a long distance, which very few people are ever going to be able to do. The question is, how quickly do you change your mind as new evidence comes in? So between the summer of 2015, when Donald Trump was indeed a very dark gray swan, and now when he is not at all, what were the cues, what were the clues that led Nate and other people to change their minds? Note, by the way, that if the question in summer of 2015 was, will Trump be the nominee or will Trump be the next president, it's not at all clear that either of those things will happen, but the likelihood of each of those things has materially increased. The question is by how much and how we go about making those determinations. And it would be interesting to hear someone like Nate talk about that.
I think there's a 95% probability that you're going to get to do that very thing. Phil, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Philip Tetlock is a professor of management and psychology at the University of Pennsylvania. He is co-leader of the Good Judgment Project, which you can find at gjopen.com.
Actually, make that 100%. Here's Nate Silver's answer.
The short answer is that there were a lot of moments, right? And you can kind of see us going from saying 2% to 5% to 10% to 20% to 50%. Now I'd say it's higher than 50%. That gradual adjustment is, at least by the textbook, consistent with what you're supposed to do, right? You're supposed to start out what we might call a prior belief. You say, candidates like Donald Trump don't usually win party nominations. And here are the reasons why. Then you adjust that view against the weight of the evidence. And when you see things that are part of your theory, that, hey, the party will organize to stop Donald Trump, and this is not happening in October, it's not happening in December, it is happening now, but maybe too late. So we did update our view over the course of the campaign.
Coming up, more on how polls and money influence election predictions and why the best answer this year may be reply hazy, try again.
This is On the Media.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. In the race to predict who's on top in this election season, the media will be awash in polls. Back in December, with our election season partners 538, we issued a Breaking News Consumer's Handbook Election Polls Edition. It was directed toward primary election coverage, but some of the points still bear repeating. Like this one. Look for polls of likely voters, not just registered voters. Also, beware polls tagged bombshells or stunners. Outliers are usually wrong. And our favorite, asking people about their votes if the election were tomorrow, is designed to heighten drama by reducing undecided responses.
In theory, polls tell us the pulse of the country. They measure public support for political initiatives, and they keep politicians answerable to their constituents, don't they? According to The New Yorker's Jill Lepore, not so much. In her 2015 article titled Politics and the New Machine, Lepore retraces the often sorry history of polling in America.
The word poll means the top of your head, like the crown of your head. You can find it in Hamlet, where Ophelia says of Polonius, he has a beard as white as snow, all flaxen was his poll. Before the rise of the paper ballot, people always voted in person. Like, you'd go to the town hall, someone would stand up, you know, on a tree trunk or something and look across the crowd and count the polls, count the tops of the heads of people on one side of the town common or the other. So that place came to be called the polls, where you would go to have your polls counted.
And then pollster was...
The word pollster is coined in 1939. It's applied to George Gallup by Time magazine, calls him a pollster. It's a bit of an homage to the great word huckster. It was a time when people were really suspicious of polls. It was a new thing, and Congress was repeatedly calling for investigations of the industry, really concerned about its role in electoral politics. We've come to accept polls as if this was a necessary piece of our electoral process. But of course, before then, that really was not the case. We had a kind of healthy criticism at the time that we, I think, have since lost.
Polls have long since gone beyond their original purpose, pre-election polls, that is, which was to track how various candidates are faring. And I wonder if you could just list the ways in which polls have become so part of the process.
They drive donors. They determine messages. They determine clout. They determine who can run. This is the first presidential election season where polls have been used to decide who gets to be on the main stage in a debate or where people stand on stage. There's just more polls. Every news story seems to need a poll to have any foundation.
All of that is fine, assuming that poll data really reflect public opinion. But there, for many reasons that you enumerate in your piece, polling doesn't necessarily accurately reflect anything. Why?
In 1935, when George Gallup founded the American Institute of Public Opinion, he sent people door to door and talked to people for maybe about 45 minutes. And the response rate, that is, the percentage of people who were asked who actually answered those questions when someone knocked at the door, was like well above 90, like 95, 96%. People were thrilled that someone came to their door and asked them what they thought. Now, a response rate of 3% is a not uncommon response rate. So even if you set aside all the other problems with polls, when only 3% of the people that you ask questions to reply, the idea that what you're getting is a statistically representative sample of the electorate is very difficult to defend.
there's another problem that you discuss, and that is that the process itself influences opinion.
It's fascinating. There's a whole very sophisticated literature that political scientists have been developing for decades on the many methodological problems of public opinion measurement. So one is this phenomenon of forced opinion. I ask you, do you favor the Smeadville-Hartley Act? And you say yes, even though you don't even know what it is. Or I ask you a leading question about that, and you say yes. There's also the problem of non-opinion. So many pollsters, if you say, I don't know, even if I don't know isn't an option, when they report their findings, won't report the percentage of respondents who said, I don't know.
One of the presumptions of polling is that it helps political leaders understand the jaws of consent, how much leeway they have to think independently versus what they owe their constituencies to represent them in Congress or wherever. But the nature of polling, particularly in elections, is that it mainly concerns itself with those likely to vote, which limits the politician's understanding of what people want to those who are willing to go to the ballot box. It disenfranchises some percentage of the population?
Yeah, and here's where, I mean, if you think back to the 1930s when Gallup was developing this tool, he argued that public opinion measurement was the best thing for democracy, really, since the secret ballot, because instead of learning the will of the people every 2 years when it came around time to vote, we, the American public, could understand the will of the people every day. Candidates could therefore be more responsive. The premise of that, though, would seem to be, and Gallup certainly would have said this at the time and did, that the people whose views are represented in the public opinion survey should be a representative sample of the American electorate. And there's where the sampling methods really matter a great deal. In practice, though, in order for not the surveys, that is, asking people their questions, they're asking people questions about their political beliefs and attitudes, but asking people who they're going to vote for, in order to make polls accurate predictions, you really only want to count the opinions of people who are going to turn out to vote. So Gallup worked by a quota system, and he just basically determined that since blacks in the South were prevented from voting, that he would have no Negro quota in any of the Southern states, and he just didn't ask black men and women how they would vote. So those polls that Gallup invented and used to measure the pulse of the American people actually only exacerbated the problems of disenfranchisement that were already weakening the democracy.
You can argue that politicians should be keeping their finger on the pulse of the electorate. And you can argue that the public deserves to know what everybody else in the body politic is thinking about a given subject. But the larger philosophical questions are, do polls seek the answers for something that doesn't even exist, namely public opinion itself?
Gallup was an ex-academic. He had gotten a PhD in applied psychology. He founded his institute at Princeton so that the Gallup Institution would have Princeton as its byline and would seem to be an academic endeavor. But social scientists from the start were extremely skeptical of the work that Gallup was doing because is the opinion of the public, are individual opinions in aggregate given equal weight that taken in an instant as a snapshot? That's actually not really defensible as a matter of social science. In 1948, right after Gallup said, you know, just watch, we'll get this election right. And then, you know, he predicted that Dewey would beat Truman, and he was famously wrong. And E.B. White, writing in The New Yorker a few days later, said, well, you know, it may be possible to take the pulse of the American people, but you can't always be sure that the American people haven't just run up a flight of stairs.
There's another actor in all of this, and that's the media. We're sort of accessories after the fact to the very kind of distortion that you're writing about.
I would quibble a little with your characterization of the press as accessories after the fact. I think the press is really the culprit here. I mean, Gallup, he was just selling a product to newspapers. He then started predicting elections just to prove that his surveys were accurate. Turned out, hey, wow, readers love these election predictions. Let's do more of them. It then became really thrilling for candidates. They're like, oh, wow, we could hire these polling firms to tell us about our candidates' chances. And this is this really important turning point in 1972 when news organizations began conducting their own polls. The press is actually not then reporting news, but is creating news. Gallup himself then came to regret this. In 1972, Congress debated a Truth in Polling Act. And Gallup was sort of like, you know, please reform the industry. This has like been taken over by a bunch of people that don't actually care about accuracy the way that I do.
We have an arrangement at On the Media with 538 for the course of this election cycle. And they made a name for themselves with a methodology for aggregating poll results in a way that favors accurate polls and subordinates inaccurate ones. But you kind of took a shot at them in your piece. You said it's a patch, not a solution.
I mean, I'm full of admiration for that work. But there are two problems. One is that good polls drive bad polls. The more unreliable polls have become, the more we rely on them. So the idea that you could sort of just say, this poll's good, this poll's bad, and therefore then we've washed our hands of the problem is a bit of a fallacy. And the other thing that's really worth noting is that other countries have laws and requirements about the non-conducting of polls this far in advance of election because the way in which they interfere with the democratic process has been demonstrated. It's incredibly helpful to say, hey, this poll is known to be reliable and this poll is known to be unreliable and let's make a prediction based on weighting the reliable one disproportionately. But it skirts the broader questions about how we choose to govern ourselves.
Well, I have one more question for you, and it concerns, naturally, Donald Trump. Has the polling culture, and particularly the way the press depends on it, created this monster?
I think it would be fair to say that Trump is a creature of the polls. One upside here is that for all the many occasions in which quite thoughtful people have issued quite thoughtful critiques of the polling industry and asked the American people to wonder whether this is in fact corrosive of our democracy, manufacturing divides that don't exist, rather than reflecting something, that the kind of uncanny rise of Donald Trump might be an occasion to actually get a little more attention to that set of critiques.
Yeah, is that going to happen?
Do I think that can happen? No. No, I don't.
Jill, thanks very much.
Hey, thanks so much.
Jill Lepore teaches at Harvard and is a staff writer for The New Yorker, where she wrote Politics and the New Machine.
So, if the poll is, say, the adjustable wrench in the prognosticator's toolbox, the hammer, no, the nails, hell, the lead pipe, is money.
It is a fact that the candidate who raises the most money often wins in American politics.
Ted Cruz could win not just Texas, but some other southern states. He has a lot of money. He's probably the best funded candidate, except for Trump, who has his own money.
Jeb Bush is amassing an unprecedented campaign war chest. In the first 6 months of the year, Bush and his allied super PAC, Right to Rise USA, raised more than $114 million.
It was the money that led many pundits to prematurely award Jeb Bush the win. But now it's clearer than ever that in presidential elections, you simply can't draw a straight line between the most money and the most votes, especially when that money is spent, as it mostly is, on ads. It's part of what Andrew Coburn in the April Harper's Magazine called the election industrial complex, in which campaign spending is designed less to elect the candidate than to enrich the campaign consultant class. Mainly, Coburn notes, they are enriched through the purchase of TV ads, which generally don't work.
That should be the reaction of anyone, because they're actually very hokey. They look like what they are, which is slapped together in a day or so in some sort of small studio and flung on the air.
The political class and their pundit buddies say, impossible. He's too outside the box.
People really like Dad. During the next few weeks, you'll be seeing a lot of commercials from us.
When I became governor, state government needed to be cut, just like my lawn. So I got to work.
One of the things in your article that really struck me is that your gut-level instinct that they couldn't possibly work was borne out.
That's right. It's very intensively studied. The effect, at most, is entirely ephemeral. You see an ad on Monday saying so-and-so is going to make the universe great again. On Tuesday, you're asked by a pollster, what do you think of so-and-so? And you think, oh, he's going to make the universe great again. And you say, I'm for him. And on Wednesday, you've entirely forgotten. The whole effect of that ad has gone away. So these enormous quantities of dollars that are poured into this are almost entirely wasted. I say almost because there are a few narrow spots where perhaps they are worth spending money on. One is when you've got a complete unknown, and the other is at the very last minute, if the election's on the Tuesday, if you dump ads on people's eyeballs on Monday, it may have an effect.
So what does work?
The ground game or field operations, that's the sort of fancy professional name for it, but it's basically going around and talking to people and not just ringing the bell saying, hi, you voting for Brooke, thank you very much, goodbye. It's been shown that if you engage people and actually talk to them, the longer the better, turn out, and presumably turn out for your side if you've chosen your people correctly, shoots up. That's been academically tested now hundreds of times.
How do consultants make money off of ads that they don't make off of a ground game?
This is the big secret of the election industrial complex. The way it works is this. Brooke Gladstone is running for higher office, okay? I'm the consultant, and I say, Brooke, we need to do a big buy in the northern part of the state. It's going to cost $1 million. So the campaign treasurer and I book time on various TV stations, and the bill comes back, and it's $1 million. And the time is bought, the ads go out, and the stations send me my commission for having brought them the business. In the old days, this was a standard 15%.
Wow.
You know, no one noticed, I should say, because they were just writing a check for $1 million and they were told they'd bought $1 million worth of ads. And the consultants didn't go out of their way to explain that 15% of that was coming back into their pocket. Then people got a bit wiser and said, well, no, 15%, we're not paying you that. How about 5, 6% and so forth? The consultants accepted that. Although I've been told, I couldn't document this, there are all sorts of underhanded ways, unbeknownst to the campaign, where you can jack that up, go as high as 30% even today.
Election industrial complex, it's a takeoff on military industrial complex.
And you see it very clearly, you know, in the defense case, you know, when money gets pumped into a weapon which fails every test and complete dog and boondoggle to visible to all concern, but carries on. When 80% or so of the money in the election industrial complex case gets pumped into something that's self-evidently almost ineffective, but enormously profitable for the people who are managing the effort, it's the same thing. You have to think about what the campaign is for. Is it to find the most efficient and cost-effective way of getting the favored candidate elected? Or is it to put money, the more the better, in the pockets of the consultants he has retained to advance his cause? It is the primary function of the election industrial complex is to look after number one itself.
But what about the ground game? Is there some inherent resistance to the ground game other than the fact that the consultants don't make a percentage on it?
There's a couple of objections, including the one you just mentioned. There's no real money in it. It's kind of hard work. You have to start very early. You have to recruit volunteers. But there's another problem, too, which is the people that you need to do this are, by definition, pretty committed, the people who go around door to door or make all those phone calls. So they're liable to feel a bit more strongly about issues than you do. That can be kind of awkward. You want to keep control of the message. If you suddenly have to depend on people who have a slightly different view and a more extreme view of what needs to be done than you, you're building up a problem for yourself. So I think there's an instinctive reaction in the machine against going too far.
Volunteers are wild cards?
They're wild cards. You know, they all, I defy you to find a candidate or a campaign manager who won't tell you, yeah, the ground game, that's where it's at. You know, we're really putting a huge amount of resources into our field operations. That's the key, getting the people engaged. But then you look at what they spent their money on. It all turns out to be TV all over again.
Let's talk about the other aspects of this. With the rise of the super PACs, you've got Mr. and Mrs. Billionaire with their vanity candidates. These people weren't all that big on oversight, right? And plus, super PACs don't get any.
Right. That's the beauty of super PACs. As one consultant said to me, I love super PACs. He says, like living under the golden arches. No need to talk to the candidate, no need to talk to the staff, no need to talk to the voters. Just put up a bunch of TV ads and sit back and let the money roll in. Because there's this wonderful legal stipulation about super PACs is that the campaigns aren't allowed to contact them. The 1% or the 1% of 1% or whatever it is, They don't know. It's not their business. They happen to hear about TV commissions, for instance. I can say, well, that's a standard deal, you know. Of course, this is the way the business operates. Everyone does this, 15%, or pushing it a bit, 25%. Yes, thank you, Mr. Billionaire. You know, so the consultant class loves super PACs for just this reason.
Okay, so let's not leave out the media, especially the broadcasters who, in these troubled times, may actually count on campaign spending to keep their stations afloat in the lean years. Do we spy a potential conflict of interest?
I think one hits a smack dab on the nose. When I talk about the election industrial complex, I definitely include the broadcast industry because, in a way, they're the major component because that $7 or $8 billion, maybe more, that this election is going to cost, the largest chunk of that will go straight into the pockets of the broadcasters, which is why the broadcasters heartily endorse the whole notion of big money politics and, you know, excessive spending.
Well, they don't necessarily endorse it, but I certainly haven't heard reported in any detail about how ineffective television ads are.
You don't hear that, do you? I can't think why not. But when you say they don't endorse it, I mean, they do off camera, so to speak. Les Moonves, the boss of CBS, in 2012, he said, super PACs may be bad for the country, but they're certainly good for CBS. This year, he said, the more they spend, the better it is for us. Go, Donald. We're looking forward to a very exciting political year in 2016.
But it's interesting because Donald Trump has spent relatively little on his campaign. Only recently has he spent much at all on campaign ads. How does Trump figure into the election industrial complex?
Oh, I think if he hadn't been there, they would have wanted to invent him. He's been wonderful for them. He's in a fantastic ratings draw. That's point one. And point two is, of course, all these stop Trumpers around the place are dashing to express themselves in the only way they know how, which is by spending millions of dollars on TV ads denouncing him. There's one called Our Principles, which I know has raised millions and millions of dollars to run Stop Trump ads financed by the Ricketts family in Chicago, who should know better.
Now, with cash-rich candidates like Jeb Bush and Scott Walker failing so spectacularly, are the donors and campaigns finally going to wise up?
You'd think, but that's what one could have said after 2012. In fact, Karl Rove raised all these hundreds of millions of dollars, and of the people he was trying to get elected, he succeeded once. I mean, one congressman. In fact, the donors were so annoyed, one of them even tried to sue him for fraud. So everyone thought, well, maybe people will wise up. But, you know, this time we got more money than ever pouring in. It's drilled into all of us that elections come at a high price. There's no way around it. You've got to buy scads and scads of TV time and shower the American people with mail and take endless polls in hopes of just getting them to stagger out to the poll and maybe put a cross against your name.
Last week you tweeted, Andrew, liberals shouldn't fret about big money controlling elections. The consultants swipe it. Is that the lesson?
I think it is. One of the reasons I wrote this thing was I was getting tired of, you know, people mobilizing to defeat Citizens United and that the problem is the money, which implicitly accepts that money wins. As I tried to explain in this piece, you know, money doesn't win.
So then the real lesson is, if voters want to fix the system, then they actually just have to
be involved. The money is, in a way, designed to shut you out. So, yeah, it would be a major effect.
Andrew, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Andrew Coburn is Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. We spoke to him about his piece, Down the Tube, Television Turnout and the Election Industrial Complex. Coming up, the worst of the worst prognosticators in a little segment we're calling Crystal's Balls.
I didn't know that. This is on the media.
Hi. I got my potato.
On Radiolab.
And I'm looking at it and I'm holding it.
We consider the mundane.
It's a handsome shape.
And stop to smell the potatoes.
I've been telling people about my potato. They're always surprised, and I say, you wouldn't understand.
Small potatoes on Radiolab.
It's my friend.
Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. At times, the reliability race between polling and punditry has felt like a battle for last place, a competition for who's wrong first and worst. What if there were a better way to divine the will of the electorate? What if there were a city or town that dependably reflected the mood and preferences of the country as a whole? It's a notion that's captured the imagination for decades. Magic Town is a 1947 Jimmy Stewart movie set in the fictional, demographically perfect town called Grandview.
This might be it, Ike. This might be it. Shortcut I've been searching for. Now look. Look at Hoopendecker's letter. Look at Stringer's figures. Stringer canvassed thousands of people all over the country. Hoopendecker canvassed a handful in a little small town. One little town. Look at the result. Look at that. 69.1, 69. They're just to say identical. I tell you, Ike, this might be it. Now listen. Think of this. One small town that thinks exactly the way the nation does.
The film's premise was based on a sociology experiment called the Middletown Studies, in which researchers used Muncie, Indiana, as America in microcosm to investigate the forces at work in the nation as a whole. But it may be that an actual magic town exists, about 120 miles from Muncie in Vigo County, Indiana, a town called Terre Haute. As far back as 1888, Vigo County has picked the winner of every presidential election but two. It missed on William Howard Taft in 1908 and was just 100 votes shy of picking Dwight Eisenhower in 1952. Filmmaker Don Campbell pulled up stakes in Brooklyn and moved to Terre Haute to find out what makes its people history's most reliable presidential bellwether.
In a community like this, there's not that much difference in a Democrat and a Republican.
I worry about my children and my grandchildren.
I live paycheck to paycheck.
I don't think it's different from any other town in America.
They forget us once they're there.
You know, you're not going to beat up anybody because they're a Republican or a Democrat. And that's democracy.
Campbell is calling his documentary project Bellwether 2016. He says his mission isn't to improve polling, but simply to understand the people of magical Terre Haute.
I want to try and unpack what makes this town tick. With all the changes that we've seen in American society over the last 100, 130 years, how has this place stayed in sync with that?
Tell me what kind of questions that you're asking to, you know, get your finger on their pulse.
What are you saving money for? What do you want to buy in your future? And then what do you want to see for the community? What do you want to see for this country? What do you think gets in our way? My hope now is to spin that out more into, okay, what are you thinking about the race?
Don, I want to play you some tape that you provided for us of a local barber with whom you spoke while he was cutting hair.
When I was down in Washington, D.C., and people said to me, oh, well, you know what, we're not interested in Terre Haute because Terre Haute, the minority population is too small. It's only 7%. National average is 12%.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you relate to that?
How do you not care about a human being? Whether they're black, whether they're white, whether it's the minority community or the majority community. How do you not care? No matter how small the numbers are. Because unless you get total input, then you don't have a full picture.
What do you think it is, if it isn't purely demographics, that makes Vigo County so in sync with the rest of the electorate?
You know, look, some of it's got to be luck. But so many of the factors that are influencing the political emotion of the year come together here. You know, one of the things that Terre Haute prides itself on is this being the crossroads of America. In this town, you have still this strong surviving manufacturing center that was based on rail, that was based on coal mining. This was the hometown of Eugene Debs, the U.S. socialist. And downtown, there's a union hall on almost every other corner. The Teamsters Union, the Carpenters Union, the Plumbers Union, the Steamfitters Union, the Electricians Union, the Operators Union, the Laborers Union. It's an academic center. There are five colleges here, and you still have a genuine urban core. You're looking at a county of about 108,000, and a little under 60,000 live in the city proper, Terre Haute, and so about another 50,000 live outside in more rural parts of Vigo County. There's an image that we have in our head that I think of as being middle America, small town, wood frame houses on a grid layout, people waving to each other and saying hi, and everybody in town kind of knows everybody. That is kind of the reality in Terre Haute.
You describe Terre Haute in rather idyllic terms. And yet the people you've spoken to don't necessarily voice a whole lot of optimism about their future.
That was Strand and Steel. They left. G.I. Case left. Columbia Records left. That's the story of Terre Haute in the last 30 years. Those were high-wage jobs. And now, everything is minimum wage and a little above minimum wage.
I think it's really reflective of what's happened in small and mid-sized cities across the nation. You drive through neighborhoods where houses are falling down, houses are abandoned. The economic infrastructure that built middle America, they feel like it's passed them by. There's 3,144 counties in the United States. Now, 50% of the population lives in 146 counties. There's almost 3,000 counties that account for the other 50% of the American population. Those 3,000 counties, we don't pay a lot of attention to them.
Well, to that point, of the 15 or 20 candidates who at various points in this process have stood for the nomination, how many of them have come through town?
Well, zero. At least in this cycle. I know that in 2008, when Indiana was a contested primary, that Obama and Clinton did both campaign here.
Change is not continuing the same tax policies of George Bush, giving tax breaks to companies that are shipping jobs overseas. Change is making sure those tax breaks go to companies that are investing right here in Terre Haute, right here in the United States of America.
Certainly in the 50s and 60s, candidates came more frequently. I mean, everybody talks about Jack Kennedy speaking at the corner of 7th and Wabash, which is the crossroads of America. They like to call it the main intersection downtown.
We're having this conversation the day after the Super Tuesday primaries, assuming that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump go on to win the party's nominations. Let's just assume that for the moment. From what you understand of the town so far, who's the next president of the United States?
You know, people have been asking me since I got here. And, you know, from the outside, I would have thought, oh, this is bound and determined to be a solid Hillary community with strong union Democrats. But pretty much as soon as I started talking with people about the election in the fall, you heard two names over and over again. And neither of them were Hillary Clinton. They were Trump and Sanders. You know, there's such a sense from a large section of the population, we need to just blow it up and start over again. I think whether this place is a demographic cross-section of America or not, it's a real cross-section of American attitude and aspiration today. And that I think the candidates could do real well to come and spend time here. There may not be a ton of votes, but they're going to hear something very real about what matters to people.
Don Campbell, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. Pleasure.
Don Campbell is the documentary filmmaker behind Bellwether 2016 at bellwether2016.org. Remember, there's no A in Bellwether.
Thank you.
So this is the year that indicators have been on the fritz across the board. The polling numbers weren't as reliable as expected. The money chased the wrong candidates. The endorsements fell flat. But focusing too much on the quirks of this election season obscures an important fact. The media always make mistakes. Submitted for your consideration, Bill Kristol. Kristol is the editor of the conservative Weekly Standard, a pundit notable for being one of the wrongest people in politics. In fact, his predictions are so reliably off the mark that they've earned the catchphrase, Kristol Ball, the premise being that if Kristol predicts it, the opposite will be true.
He was an outspoken advocate of the Biden will run narrative last year.
Joe Biden's going to get in, I'm quite confident. He will signal that he would like to have Elizabeth Warren as his running mate.
Or not. Kristol, a vocal opponent of Donald Trump, uses the hashtag Peak Trump whenever he predicts that his campaign is washed up, which since last summer he has done again.
I think we are past peak Trump.
And again.
I think he's hit a ceiling of about 30%. I do think we're at peak Trump.
But Kristol's predictile dysfunction isn't limited to this election cycle. In 2006, he said that Barack Obama wouldn't win a single primary against Hillary Clinton.
Kristol routinely admits he's a feeble forecaster.
I kind of like being in denial. You know? It's generally a healthy psychological. It's a healthy psychological state often compared to facing reality.
You're not just making a prediction about what's going to happen. They're making a statement of what they hope will happen.
Phil Tedlock says the reason pundits like Kristol seem unruffled by their never-ending errors is that, unlike weather forecasters, political pundits are engaged in magical thinking.
And they hope they will increase the likelihood of that thing happening by saying it.
Tedlock offers the example of former Clinton advisor turned GOP talking head Dick Morris. In 2012, Morris predicted Mitt Romney would win by a landslide.
It will be the biggest surprise in recent American political history. It will rekindle a whole question as to why the media played this race as a nail-biter.
And Morris insisted he was backed by cold, hard science.
I base this not on intuition or on smelling the tea leaves. I base it on reading the polls. It's not a question of being smarter than anybody else. It's that I've done this for a living. And there are very few people on television who talk about politics who've ever made a living doing it.
Wrong and also wrong. What's remarkable is not Morris's stupefying miscalculation, but his admission to Fox's Sean Hannity a week later.
I spoke about what I believed, and I think that there was a period of time when the Romney campaign was falling apart, people were not optimistic, and I felt that it was my duty at that point to go out and say what I said. And at the time that I said it, I believe I was right.
And there we have it. The final vector that explains why, election after election, pundit predictions are mostly baloney. It's because the prognosticators want them to be true.
And if the evidence says otherwise, well,
people are more inclined to say, okay, I have a hypothesis. I'm now going to go out and essentially market my hypothesis rather than go out and find evidence that challenges my assumptions.
Evan Osnos is a writer for The New Yorker. In an episode of their Politics and More podcast, he highlighted the tendency of pundits to see themselves as exemplars of the American mind.
You can have the perception that you are encompassing the universe of American opinion when, in fact, you are looking at a set of views of already self-selecting people who agree with you. The reality is a lot of the people who write these stories, ourselves included, live in places like Washington, D.C. and New York. And when you go out to Iowa and New Hampshire, it takes about 5 minutes before you discover that there is this enormous anger out there. The seclusion, in effect, of the part of the media that has a big megaphone from what is, in fact, the lived experience on the ground of a lot of Americans mean that we've been caught off guard.
But we don't need to look to The New Yorker to know this. Here's The New York Times' David Leonhardt on OTM last July.
Donald Trump is almost certainly not going to be the Republican nominee. He has never won elected office. He looks nothing like the profile of people who win campaigns. He is attracting almost no support from Republican elected officials and from Republican operatives and from Republican donors. So Donald Trump is almost certainly not going to be the nominee.
Or we could look even closer at me, because 1 month before that clip aired, I said this. From birther ravings to comparing Obamacare to Nazism to declarations of Native Mexican criminality, Trump is absolutely a joke. along the lines of the kid in geometry class making fart sounds in his armpit. Now, I wasn't a shill for the Clinton campaign, nor was I for the Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio campaigns. I wasn't lying, and I wasn't trying to diminish Trump's odds. I didn't think he had any odds. I was just saying something that I knew to be true because I just knew it. My error, and fellow prognosticators take note, there happens to be a difference between what you think or assume or have learned from history or simply wish to believe and what's going to happen next. That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, and Jesse Brenneman. We had more help from Micah Loewinger, Emma Stelter, and Isabel Christo, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Hoford.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Overbrook Foundation and the listeners of WNYC Radio.